Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
On today's program, we speak with local farmers from Fair Share Farm in Lawson, Missouri, about the concept of natural versus artificial foods. Dave Bennett Freeling speaks with Rebecca and Tom, who each have over 20 years of experience in sustainable agriculture and who are involved in educating farmers about beginning or transitioning to farming methods that are better for the environment. Tom is a former engineer working in water quality who has a unique scientific perspective on natural foods. But first, for the environmental news for the week of 11-12-18 on Eco Radio KC, my name is Teresa Wilkie. USA Today reports, the ozone layer, which protects us from the sun's harmful radiation, is slowly healing, according to a United Nations report. The good news is due to decades of global cooperation to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals. GreenAbility magazine reports, for KCP&L customers who would like to support solar energy but are not able to purchase their own panels, Kansas City Power and Light is offering a new solar subscription program that will help build a solar farm to increase the utility's renewable energy production. The Missouri Public Service Commission approved KCP&L's plan to begin offering Missouri customers a solar subscription program to support a new 5-megawatt solar array that would be the size of 19 football fields. The exact location has not yet been determined, but a KCP&L spokesperson said it would produce enough electricity to power the equivalent of 1,000 homes. Unlike typical solar programs, this one would allow participants to be renters, homeowners, and businesses in KCP&L's Missouri territories. And pending approval from the Kansas Corporation Commission, the Kansas territory as well. Even if customers move, the KCP&L solar subscription can move with them if it's within the KCP&L customer territory. Democracy Now! Reports, a federal judge in Montana has temporarily halted the construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The court's decision will require the Trump administration to review more thoroughly the potential negative impacts of the pipeline on the surrounding environment and climate change. President Obama halted the construction of the pipeline in 2015, following mass public protests, but Trump reversed the order shortly after he came into office. Environmental and indigenous groups hailed the decision this past Thursday. Sierra Club attorney Doug Hay said in a statement, "The Trump administration tried to force this dirty pipeline project on the American people, but they can't ignore the threats it would pose to our clean water, our climate, and our communities." It's unclear now whether the Trump administration will appeal the decision. On the same subject, Bold Nebraska reports their actions will be to continue waiting for the Nebraska Supreme Court, who has heard landowners and tribes appeal challenging the Keystone Pipeline approval, route approval on November 1st. It's expected to issue its decision in early 2019. Which could force TransCanada to submit a new application and trigger a new 6 to 8 month review. Bold Nebraska has always continued to organize landowners along this new proposed pipeline route who are refusing to give up their land to a foreign corporation. As of last report, only 62% of affected landowners have signed with TransCanada. Bold Nebraska is currently finalizing a fourth location for their Solar XL project and will soon launch a final fundraising push to install more solar with landowners who live in the path of the Keystone XL. Bold Nebraska continues work with newly elected Nebraska state senators to pass legislation to end the abuse of eminent domain for private gain in Nebraska.
And thank you for the news. This is Dave Benefreeling, and I'm here with Rebecca Graff and Tom Ruggieri of Fair Share Farm, and also just general educated farmers in Kansas City, educated growers and people who are in the know in terms of our local growing seasons and ways to get things out of the ground and not do too much damage to the earth in the process. And they're going to educate us today about how we can eat more natural foods, grow more natural foods, and real natural foods. When we hear the word natural, a lot of times we, some of us, you know, are attracted to that, and other people really see through that because you see things that say natural flavors or, you know, all natural. And, you know, most educated people these days are kind of skeptical of that. But we're going to find out what that really means. There really is something to calling food natural. And so let's find out more about that. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Dave.
And Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks.
Great to have you here. And so you all have a farm in Kansas City, right?
Yes. We're about 45 minutes from downtown Kansas City in northeast Clay County, just a little bit north of Excelsior Springs near Lawson.
Yeah, yeah, it's some beautiful kind of rolling hills up there, right?
It is, yes. We're on my family's land, and it's where I grew up, and where my grandparents and father farmed the land for many generations, and now for the last 16 years, Tom and I have been managing the farm and growing organic vegetables.
Excellent. And that's gone pretty well so far, right? You've got some.
Yeah, it's a challenging occupation. It's not easy work, but we love it, and we've been very fortunate to have a great community of supporters that have helped us build the farm and improve the land, and eat really well in mm-hmm. the process.
Yeah, and that's part of what you do, because community-supported agriculture, so you have a CSA where you provide food to people on a weekly basis throughout a portion of the year, and they provide you all with some income for that in return, right?
Right, yeah. Community-supported agriculture is an amazing model for small farms to get a guaranteed sales of the produce that they grow and build community at the same time. So we have, right now what we're doing is a 16-week season starting in mid-April going until right before Thanksgiving. So we're on our last week coming up this week of the season. And people pay in advance of the season. So that helps us out economically because a lot of our expenses are in the late winter, early spring in preparation for the season, growing season. And then we actually have a work requirement with our CSA. So each family has to come out to the farm once during the year and help out with the harvest. And that's just a huge benefit to us to get to know the people who are eating our food and get some help with the harvest. And also, they form a relationship with the land where their food is coming from, and they understand more about what it takes to grow the food, what the, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, they're out there on the farm seeing exactly what, how their food is grown, so there's no, you know, it's completely transparent in that way.
So they got to invest with some sweat.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, this summer was pretty sweaty, so yeah, there was definitely some sweat invested.
But it could be fun. Fun for some, I think.
Exactly,
for a lot
of, yeah. We like to get the whole family out. We love having people bring their kids out, and, you know, we try and make it very family-friendly and very enjoyable, while at the same time, you know, getting some work done.
All right. And, Tom, you've been farming out there with Rebecca for how many years now?
So this is our 16th season.
Yeah, and before you started that, what were you up to?
So I went to school to become an engineer, became an environmental engineer, and worked in that field for about 20 years. I kind of tried to drop out of it several times. In the corporate world, you're really just kind of taking care of the messes that a business will create, and just trying to keep them out of trouble. It was more about liability and money than about the environment. So I never really wasn't a good fit for me. And the farming that Rebecca and I do is really a lot more like environmental engineering than what I was doing. But the training I got, the experience, the education was extremely helpful for what we're doing here in agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think somebody with a mind for engineering would be a good resource for farming, it seems like.
Yeah. What is nice about environmental engineering that it, a lot of it's based on biology.
Mm-hmm.
Wastewater treatment and a lot of, you know, pollution control is biological. And so that's the part of it that I really liked. And agriculture, even food, you know, we're all biology, and so it's nice to see it from so many different angles.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now, what you guys, you refer to your farming style. It's technically, are you guys organic? Is this an organic farm, certified organic?
We're not certified.
Yeah. And so you really don't tend to advertise organic necessarily. I mean, there's some questionable, you know, it may be questioned, I guess, if you do that. But you call what you do biological farming.
Mm-hmm.
So tell our listeners a little bit about that, because they might not know what that means.
Yeah, you know, USDA, you know, unless you're certified, you're not allowed to list your farm as organic. And in other parts of the world, it's called biological farming. And I think that describes it better. So a lot of so-called conventional agriculture is based on the use of synthetic chemicals. Synthetic chemicals are used to feed the plant, to kill weeds, to kill pests, just everything, single step along the way is based on a man-made chemical, whereas biological, it's based on a natural system, you know, the natural order of things. And that's what we do. You know, we don't use any synthetics in our the production of the food. So that's really the fundamental difference right there.
And so it's about working within the ecosystem that you're growing in and kind of being a part of that.
Yeah. We focus on the soil. So, you know, that's the thing about the earth. It's this big ball out there, and there's a skin of life on it that's always been there, and the soil is the basis of that. And that's what we focus on, is growing the life in the soil so that the life of the crops that we grow, that's what they come out of.
Mm-hmm. So what are some things you do to enrich the soil or to work with the soil?
Well, one of the main things we do is we feed the soil. So, you know, you got to kind of look at the soil as really kind of an organism on its own. It needs a diverse diet. You know, you want to feed it solid food. So we'll grow cover crops, you know, cowpeas and, you know, oats, something like that. Crops that we would eat as people, but we grow the plants, and before they fruit out, we turn them under, and then that's digested by all the organisms in the soil, and that's how the nutrients get to the plant. You know, that's more the natural order of thing. Life grows, it dies, and then the next generation of life, that's where they get their food. Our plants eat solid food versus a conventional agriculture. You take synthetic chemicals that are produced by man and you feed it in like a soluble form. That's what you do when somebody's sick. It's like, you know, no solid food for you. So that's kind of a, you know, shows some of the fundamental differences between biological and chemical-based farming.
And you said cowpeas, not cowpea. So the cow doesn't pee on your property. You don't have cows. So do you use any manure on your property at all?
We do have laying hens, so they are an important part of our fertility plan. So we have two flocks, usually, that we rotate around the fields. They are free rangers, but they are inside of electronetting to protect them from predators and also to keep them where we want them. So we, you know, after a crop has been harvested and we're done, you know, with that area of the farm, we will put the chickens in there, and they will eat up all the plant matter that's left and the bugs, and, you know, they're really good at breaking up the top inch or so of soil and looking for things in the ground and, you know, really cleaning it all up for us. And then, of course, you know, they are biological animals, so they do some depositing of their fertilizer for us, so we don't have to go out there and spread compost. They put it out there themselves, and then it is digested, and, you know, after a length of time, you know, to make sure that everything is well digested, then we can go back into that area and plant a new crop. And it will thrive with all of that lovely fertility from our laying hens.
And so, yeah, you want to wait sometimes so you don't have a lot of certain types of bacteria, I guess, on the surface. But you are encouraging bacterial growth in the soil overall, of some bacteria, right? This is a living system, like it's a stomach or an intestine.
Right.
So we want to have the bennies, the beneficial microorganisms in there to help kind of enrich the soil and kind of create a system, right, where things are breaking down and then feeding at the same time, right?
Right. Like you said, you know, we tell people the soil is the stomach of the plant. So, yes, you feed it food, it breaks it down, and then those nutrients are released to the plants. And, you know, our digestive system is the same way. You know, we're a symbiotic creature. We have microorganisms in our body, and they play a very important role in not just the digestion of our food, but we're learning more and more about how they are beneficial as far as our immune system. I mean, they're just finding out more and more every day. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense. You know, that's our natural state. Until a couple hundred years ago, everybody in the world ate food that was grown within a stone's throw of where they lived, and it wasn't sanitized, and so the microorganisms that was in the soil of where they lived was in their body. And that was the acclimation that everybody had.
Yeah. So this is working within the system. I'm going to throw another question at you. I didn't prepare you guys for this one, but so this summer I saw some farms in Europe that they were talking about this kind of biodynamic agriculture. So how does what you guys do differ from something like that?
Yeah, Tom and I actually, when we were apprentices, so we apprenticed on farms for kind of 2 years before we started our own farm, and both of those farms did do some biodynamic practices. There's a wide range of practices. Some of them are based on the calendar, you know, planting during certain times of the month, when certain celestial bodies are in certain places in relation to the earth. I am not an expert on biodynamic farming, by the way. So we did follow some of those practices when we first started. We never did, like, preparations and things. It's pretty involved. It's pretty esoteric. But in our experience, we didn't really see a big difference between, you know, planting one day versus another. And for us, it just came down to, with the weather and our erratic climate and everything, sometimes you just have one day, one hour to get things planted. So trying to stay to this, you know, kind of strict calendar was just not really working. So we've had really productive harvests. And so, yeah, we're not a biodynamic farm, but it's an interesting concept. And, you know, Rudolf Steiner, who came up with the biodynamic farming, you know, he's also the father of Waldorf and, you know, a lot of really innovative ideas. And, yeah, we don't have anything against those folks. We're just not quite organized enough or not quite spiritual enough for it or something.
Yeah. You know, the weather had more of an impact than, you know, where Jupiter was for us. Mm-hmm. But the thing about biodynamic, too, is it's based on minimizing the amount of inputs into your farm and incorporating animals into the operation of your farm. And those are both goals of ours and things that we've moved towards. So we embrace that. It's more the, like you said, kind of the spiritual side of it that we haven't delved into.
Yeah. So if you were to look at your farm versus the biodynamic farm, they're not too different in terms of the appearance, the general methods, but there's some specifics there that are.
Yeah, I would think philosophy, you know, there's a very common philosophy and big part of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So y'all came up at a time when there was fewer and fewer farms in Missouri, small farms. Missouri, I know, has encountered this, you know, huge decline. It was a state that at one time I think had the most small farms of any state in the country, and of course there's not that many these days. So obviously there was some challenges that people must have been encountering, and also just trends. But what sort of challenges have you guys encountered through the years, 16 years that you've been working on that land?
Yeah. It's sad to see. I mean, in our area where we are, since we're like on the edge of kind of the suburban sprawl of Kansas City that's always creeping closer and closer to us, it was a very rural area. And especially in the last 5 years or so, it seems like there's really been a lot more development. A lot more farmland being sold into, you know, tracts of, you know, 5 acres with one house on it. And fewer actual family farms. A lot of the farms that remain are contracted out, and there's somebody coming in and planting the corn and soybeans, and then they come in and harvest, you know, spray the corn and soybeans, and then they harvest the corn and soybeans. But there's fewer and fewer actual farm families that are doing that work and actually making an income off of farming as a livelihood. So that's pretty sad to see. Although at the same time, there's been a real blossoming of small farms, especially in the urban parts, you know, of the city. And so that's been really great to see. I would just like to see more of that as my neighbors, you know. I'd like to see more places near us embrace their agricultural heritage instead of, you know, subdividing their farms and making a quick buck.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, when I met Rebecca, that's one thing that, like you say, there's a situation where all these small farms are disappearing, and meet somebody that wants to preserve that land and has the opportunity, even though, you know, we're starting at a kind of, you know, a lot of infrastructure was destroyed or abandoned that small farms depended on. So that's, you know, the challenge of even finding people to get back into it. And she was kind of took advantage of an opportunity, and that's why we're here today. So.
Yeah, yeah. And so you guys didn't. I heard that there's like a farmer hookup site, like one of those Tinder or something like that for
right.
farmers. Have you heard about that?
That
exists.
I think
farmers only.
I think I've seen the commercials. Mm-hmm. I think you're required to wear cowboy boots and flannel shirts.
So not as many biological farmers in there. Maybe though, it could be a good, if you're interested in that kind of thing. Maybe it could work for some. But that's not how you met, because that was before that. So how did you all meet up at this field?
So I was apprenticing on a CSA farm in upstate New York near Rochester, and it was a CSA farm that ended up being our model. Like we kind of copied what they were doing. They're amazing up there at Peacework. And Tom was a CSA member, and he came out to do his work shift. And it was like the first work shift of the season. So it was May, because it's later up there. It stays cold longer. So I think it was like mid-May. And yeah, I just
May
remember
20th.
Right. I remember admiring him as he, like, trimmed the leeks with this big knife over at the compost pile. He definitely had some knife skills, which, yeah, it was pretty
I love
sexy
to hear this story, because Tom gets the sweetest look in his eyes as he's looking at Rebecca as she's talking about this. So you guys met out there at that farm, and then just kept in contact or contacted each other after that.
Yeah, he was convinced by mid-season to join my crazy idea of coming back to the family farm here in Missouri. So,
Hitched our wagons, and then we came out here. Actually, we apprenticed at a farm in Indiana.
Oh, wow.
Upstate New York is just a beautiful area, but it's not Missouri. It's sandy soil, and the weather's totally different, and Indiana was a little bit more like it is here. So, you know, that's part of the challenge is how do you learn to do this? A lot of it you learn by doing, but it's nice to find some places where you can experiment on other farms as you're learning.
Yeah, and see what other people are doing and learn from some other people's mistakes or expertise. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. And so you were an intern, Rebecca, on that farm, were working on that farm. And so you guys have interns come out and work with you all, right?
We do. We have had, over the years, probably, 20, close to 20 apprentices or interns. And that's been really great for the farm to just have this influx of new, fresh energy and a fresh look at things. We've been happy to see some of our apprentices go on to start their own farms or at least be involved in agriculture in some way. And we are always looking for people that want to learn. And if you're listening, contact us. Love to talk to you.
Yeah, fairsharefarm.org, right?
We're .com. Yes.
Fairsharefarm.com.
And you can try growinggrowers.org, too. So that's a local program that helps helps in training apprentices. They set apprentices up with host farms. K-State and MU, they kind of coordinate this. And they have workshops, so you get the kind of academic training. At the same time, you get the on-the-farm training. And so it's a really good way to do it.
Yeah, and those people seem to get a great education through that.
Yeah.
Growing Growers program. All right. And they're probably committed to organic or biological farming. And it's a good thing to get committed to. We're going to come back in a few minutes and find out more about why people should be committed to that or why that's a good idea and maybe talk smack on some non-biological farming. So more to come in just a few moments. Right now, a few messages.
You never know what you're going to hear on Radioactive Magazine. We might be discussing racism or climate change or Palestinian rights or a dozen other social justice issues, featuring interviews by activists from ACLU, Indivisible KC, Black Lives Matter, many more. Whatever the topic, we promise a thought-provoking discussion. That's Radioactive Magazine's Tuesday, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This retired federal employee, Sam Scarry, encouraging all my federal employee friends to consider donating to KKFI Community Radio through this year's combined federal campaign. Just a donation of a few dollars to KKFI, agency code 21994, through payroll deduction will go a long way to helping keep KKFI on the air. So please consider donating. That's agency code 21994. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As Hurricane Florence targeted the East Coast, the Navy moved its ships away from Hampton Roads, Virginia, to keep them safe. Retired Navy Rear Admiral Ann Phillips says as an isolated incident, this did not affect national security. But as extreme weather becomes more common, the impacts are adding up.
You start to realize over time, gee, we lost more training days due to heat, or we lost more training days due to flooding. Or in the context of Florence, all the ships here in Hampton Roads sortied to avoid the storm. So their schedules have been disrupted, and then that certainly adds much more of a challenge to readiness. So can the Navy recover? Of course they can. But it does make things more challenging over time.
The newest National Defense Authorization Act requires the military to anticipate and prepare for power outages from storms and tidal flooding. It also prohibits building in risky floodplain areas without protective measures such as elevating the lowest floor. Phillips says these types of adaptations are critical.
This is a real threat. It's not imagined. It's not happening quickly, but it is happening. And the need to act to get ahead of this is urgent.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, we're about to learn some more about biological farming and also biological versus not-so-biological or chemical farming is what we could call it. So kind of contrasting some different studies that most of us are familiar with, biology and chemistry. And so a lot of farming these days is done using the wonders of modern chemistry, right? And so that's something that that you all don't indulge in quite as much. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right. We don't use synthetic chemicals.
Yeah, and so how would you define a synthetic chemical?
One that synthesized by humans.
Okay.
So, you know, there's, you know, the whole idea that, well, you know, everything, you know, chemicals with that.
Everything's chemicals a chemical. Like water's a chemical. Right,
right. Right. Yeah. But there's a big distinction between that and a synthetic chemical.
Yeah. Yeah, so these are large molecules typically that that don't break down naturally, or if they do, they might leave some byproducts that living things aren't accustomed to accommodating in their bodies. So,
right. You know, some chemicals, like in agriculture, they're synthesized to look like a natural chemical, a protein or something like that, and so they'll disrupt natural biochemical pathways or systems, and that's how, you know, you kill a weed or you get rid of some bug. And, you know, this similarity to a natural chemical is kind of a dangerous thing. It's something that, you know, isn't seen in nature, and so it's an unnatural system. And then with the other big part of so-called conventional is that we're plants are fed synthetically produced nitrogen. And, you know, it's like a cucumber in a store. It might say all natural on it, but, you know, you are what you eat, and so you are what your plants eat. So if this plant is eating, being fed nitrogen that was synthetically produced, then it is not all natural. Mm-hmm. So.
And so so this synthetic food product, the so-called cucumber that one might buy, I'm picturing these kind of rubbery, plasticky, wax-coated cucumbers that you often would get at, or many people are accustomed to getting at a grocery store. That's why everybody peels their cucumbers these days. You know, no one wants to eat that skin. But so these cucumbers are not a natural product. So why is that an issue? It sure, you know, looks like one, and maybe to some it might taste like a natural food. But what would be maybe a drawback to eating that?
Well, you know, it's a whole system. So the Fritz Haber at the turn of the 20th century created this chemical process where you could take nitrogen and out of the air and make it into like ammonia so that you could feed it to plants. And that's a soluble form of nitrogen, and it's in a very simple form. And in doing that, you've kind of, it's a reductionist approach. You've reduced everything to, you know, if you look at it like Legos, one little Lego block is what you're feeding something rather than a complex molecule. So it's a different system. Like I say, it's not apples and apples and apples and oranges. It's apples and synthetic chemicals. So natural and chemical-based is very, very different. And we were up in Nebraska last year, and they do a lot of applying of soluble nitrogen to the fields up there, and it's polluted their groundwater. So, I mean, there's other impacts besides the fact that the food that you eat really doesn't have the complexity of a food that's raised biologically. You're polluting the groundwater of the next generation, and we, you know, it's known that that happens, and there's really no cost that's associated with that, a negative cost for conventional agriculture. So it's not even a very fair system.
Yeah. And so there's it sounds like there you're so far you've talked about, you know, there's jobs in, you know, what you all are doing. There's people working with you, and you guys are working. There's also jobs in these industries that are producing these things. And if you kind of compare, you know, I think about you know, the health of people's workplaces. And your workplace health is a lot of fresh air, working mm-hmm. with things that our bodies are evolved to survive with, whereas maybe in industrial agriculture, there's a lot of jobs, but some of those jobs are working in a factory where they're producing chemicals, and there's a lot of byproducts that might be harmful that you're going to take home on your clothes and take home to your kids. And mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's also the various waste products of these industries, and a lot of them are dealing with waste products in the first place because that's a cheap way to deal with them, is to put them on crops. And so there's a whole lot of, it sounds like there's a whole lot of, you know, either way, there's jobs that could go towards working with people on a biological farm, or working with more of a synthetic chemical farming. You know, which one do you want to invest in?
Right.
I think the farm worker experience is a big part of why I wanted to, when I decided to come back to the family farm, to farm organically. I think that we really need to pay attention to their experience. Like, that's a big reason to buy organic. Whether or not you think it's better, or, you know, it's going to keep you from getting cancer, all those things are, you know, you don't know. But you know that the farm workers are not going to be getting in contact with these toxic chemicals when they're harvesting and when they're picking, or they're the ones out there spraying. You know, there's higher incidences of cancers in agricultural areas where it's, you know, an industrial approach. So I think that if we really saw what the farm workers had to go through on a daily basis, we'd be much more interested in, you know, supporting organic farms that don't treat their workers that way.
Yeah, it sounds like at multiple levels. So the farm worker and the surrounding homeowners, or,
right.
or people.
Yeah,
who
the environment, the wildlife that live in the area, the community that lives near these fields. You know, a lot of, we've had some aerial sprayers near us, and it's always frightening when you see a plane flying over spraying chemicals near your farm. And, you know, in some of these industrial agricultural communities, that's happening all the time. And you know that stuff doesn't just stay, you know, within the boundaries of the farm field. You can smell it, you know, pretty far away from where they're actually trying to spray it. There's huge impacts.
And have you had other issues with maybe surrounding influences on your property from other, you were talking earlier about encroachment of maybe some suburban sprawl. Have you recognized any impacts on your property, maybe to your water, to your land, or to your air, that maybe from some of those neighbors?
Yeah, we're lucky in that the farm where we are, so our family farm is 280 acres, so it's a pretty big area. We are not growing all those acres in organic vegetables. We grow a couple acres of crops for our CSA and for our kitchen. But the rest of the farm is actually native grasses now. So we have this buffer between us and the neighboring corn and soybean fields. That being said, like I said, you know, that stuff volatilizes. It's in the air. It's not like if we, you know, we paid for some really fancy testing, I'm sure we would find pesticide residue everywhere on every inch of, you know, America almost. You know, like it's not just staying within the fence boundaries. But we are fortunate that our watershed, we're farming ridgetops, so we're at the beginning of our watershed, so there isn't another farm that drains onto our property. But yeah, you can't. We're not in a bubble. We're definitely in a community, and most of our neighbors are not organic farmers. So, yeah.
Yeah, but you feel like you're providing some benefit to your land, and I know that you've done some data collection on the impact of your farming methods over time, and so what have you found in terms of your your footprint or your impact over the years.
Yeah. So that's where, you know, my training as an environmental engineer has helped a lot. You know, it's funny, when I met Rebecca and we first started doing it, my mom was alive. She'd always say, are you using what you learned in college, you know, and what you're doing? And you know, I really am now, because we've collected soil data for 16 years. One of the key things we look at is the organic matter. And we've raised it, the organic matter in the 5 acres or so where we grow, from between 2 and 3% to between 4 and 5%. What that means is we've actually grown or raised topsoil at the same time we've raised vegetables. And that organic matter in the soil is basically carbon. So we've taken carbon dioxide out of the air and put it into the ground. So we've sequestered carbon. And you can calculate that. And over the last 10 years, we've sequestered over 400,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. And so when you take that, and we also buy renewable energy from our electric co-op. We have solar panels on our farm for our irrigation system. We have one tractor that's electric. So we do have, like, you know, it took gasoline to get down here today and stuff like that. But if you add it all up, we actually have a negative carbon footprint, and we have for the past 10 years. So we're trying to, you know, demonstrate that that's all possible, too. And as farmers, we want to try and get some of that, educate people, you know, to get the value that we deserve from that, and, the benefit. Because the chemical agriculture we're talking about, like I said, that you go to Nebraska, I've read their reports from the Department of Environmental Quality for the state, and the groundwater is polluted, and the general public pays for that. The people that put these pollutants in the groundwater don't. So conventional agriculture doesn't pay for all the diminishment that they create, and we're not getting paid for the benefits we're providing. So, you know, something has to change there someday, and that we're trying to point out that difference and that discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. So paying for kind of environmental impact and looking at the overall economic costs and benefits of business.
Right. True cost of food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's because people talk about the cost of things, and they, you know, that's a concern for everyone is economics, but economics could be broadened and to looking at, you know, the resources as economics, not just cash or, you know, income and accounts, but resources as
right.
As the economic way of looking at it. Yeah. And so overall, it sounds like you're having a more positive impact on your property than maybe a conventional farm, what was referred to as a conventional mm-hmm. farm, or, you know, conventional farms is the term that's commonly used for a chemical farm or mm-hmm. you know, non-biological farm. So we're learning some great terminology here. Biological.
I like to say so-called conventional, because if you look up the word convention, it means agreement. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, who agreed that conventional is, you know, the way we should all do it?
I'm sure there were some multinationals
right.
back in the 50s that made some agreements.
But some other things with kind of what we've been doing, I think it's just the diversity that we've helped to create on the farm, you know. We have we're a diversified vegetable operation, so it's naturally diverse, but that's part of biology. Biology is based on diversity. So every step of the way that we can, we create a more diverse environment on the farm, like we have insectaries and...
Yeah, the last couple of years we've really tried to focus on encouraging beneficial insects on the farm that can help us with our pests so that we don't have to use the organic sprays as much. So we're planting insectaries in between our crops so that there's a place where things like lacewings and ladybugs, of course, but a lot of these, like, bigger predators that, you know, like the praying mantis and all these different creatures that are wanting to eat the pests that give us a hard time. So that's been fun, because then you also have all these little flowering things like
you know, even letting basil and cilantro flower. We grow a lot of alyssum. Alyssum is a really easy beneficial to grow, and it really brings in the little tiny, tiny wasps that aren't going to sting you. They're going to lay their eggs inside of caterpillars, and then their little baby wasps are going to eat the caterpillar from the inside out. So, you know, so lots of little tiny flowering things, and just like a undisturbed space for some of the predatory insects that need to have a place to live. That's been really fun, and I think it's an easy thing, and you know, it's nice to have some flowering plants in the garden anyway.
And it's a natural system. You talk about natural versus artificial, you know, it's creating a natural system. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, being more in symbiosis with your property and with the living things there, and trying to create more of that. That's really a big challenge for humanity, is that we have impacted the earth so much that it's hard to even imagine what the natural state of the property anywhere is. Mm-hmm. But if you kind of, you know, help it thrive and let it go for a little bit, maybe you can see some of that come back.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing what comes back, what you can bring. I mean, these things just come, right?
Mm-hmm. Right,
they just arrive out of nowhere.
We were talking about that earlier, like, you know, so we've started a fermenting kitchen. We're making sauerkraut and kimchi and a wild fermentation. So we don't, it's kind of a side topic, but, you know, we don't buy a package of culture bacteria and put it on our cabbage to make sauerkraut. We just harvest the cabbage in the field, add salt, and the little lactobacillus is there on the leaves, and it predominates and it makes wonderful sauerkraut. It's amazing how resilient nature is. If you just give it space, it's able to come back. When we started farming, we were going from a soil that had been conventionally farmed corn and soybeans to an organic system, and the first couple years, things did not thrive. It was a rough transition, and I think a lot to do with the fact that the soil was kind of dead. But then we didn't go out there and sprinkle microorganisms around. You know, we just stopped killing them. You know, that's what they were being, you know, sprayed with things and being killed, and just stopped doing that, and all of a sudden they came back. Yeah, and give them some food to eat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
it's pretty simple, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Just takes time. You know, that's the whole thing with a lot of, you know, chemical-based systems. People don't take time, and, you know, they won't take the time to let these things happen. You know, if 50 years ago when USDA said, you know, get bigger, get out to agriculture, and that's when industrial ag started. They'd even said, well, take 10% of the land in the country, and we're going to put full force of the United States behind you to build soil. You'd have farms right now that would have 50 years of soil building. Mm. You know, our story is based on 16 years, and we've seen just this great improvement. You know, 34 years from now, you know, then compare, you know, organic or biological agriculture to chemical-based. Mm-hmm. You know, people say that organic isn't as good, but there's no time frame that you're really allowed to do this comparison.
So building the soil is where a lot of it starts. So if people wanted to build the soil, what would be some ways they could find out more about that? And just in general, what are some sources of information you all might recommend to people who want to encourage this or learn more about it?
Yeah, I think the Growing Growers program is really good, and they open their workshops up to the public, so you can attend one or two or all of them. You know, there's so many resources online, and I mean, we go to farmer conferences when we can. A great resource that we love is the Farmer to Farmer podcast, which is Chris Blanchard recently passed away, but he did an amazing job of interviewing organic farmers all over the country
And I think there's, well, there are over 100 podcasts of his interviews with them. So if you're really interested in learning more about organic farming, that's a great resource.
Yeah, there's different books. ATRA is a national kind of education program, ATTRA, where you can find a lot of publications. And you just have to start doing stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can increase the organic matter in your soil by adding compost. You know, home gardens will do that a lot. But it's also good to grow crops and turn them in, you know. Like I say, just diversity in what you feed your soil.
All right. Feed the soil, folks. So, so yeah, if you want to learn more about this, growinggrowers.org or ATRA are some great sources. Also, if you'd like to find Fair Share Farm, you guys are going to be at the Brookside Winter Market. Is that right?
That's right.
And that's happening when? When do those occur?
This Saturday is the holiday market, so it would be a good one to come to familiarize yourself with the Brookside Market if you haven't already.
And what's the date and day and time?
Saturday at from 9 to noon at the
HCA.
So go to brooksidefarmersmarket.org.
.org, yeah, that's right. All right. Actually, that may be .com now that I think
.com,
about it. I
yeah.
think it is .com.
Okay.
So Brookside Farmers Market, you could just Google that. They've also got a Facebook page and find out more about that. Well, thank you so much, Tom Ruggieri and Rebecca Graff from Fair Share Farm. And we learned so much about natural food that now I feel like I really want to eat natural food and not, and I question myself when I say natural food. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been great education. So now we got some more words from our sponsors and we'll be coming up with Fiesta Musical in just a few moments. Thanks for listening, folks.
Wolves are restoring streams in Yellowstone. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Tuesday's election results were a mixed bag for the environment. In Washington State, a proposed tax on carbon was rejected by more than 56% of the voters. It was the second time a carbon fee had been considered there, and the race attracted much money from the oil and gas industry in opposition.
Large oil and gas funding also helped opponents defeat a proposed law in Colorado that would have required new drilling to be set back 2,500 feet from schools, homes, and water sources.
In two states, voters considered proposals to require electrical utilities to obtain 50% of their power from renewable sources like wind and solar. In Arizona, the initiative failed, but it won in Nevada, where it still must be passed again by voters in 2020 to become effective.
In Florida, residents said yes to banning offshore oil and gas drilling in state waters. The tourism industry, as well as environmentalists, supported the proposal.
Two states rejected proposals aimed at protecting clean water. Montana voters decided against stricter standards on the mining industry, and Alaskans rejected a measure to guard salmon.
10 gubernatorial candidates who campaigned on moving away from fossil fuels won election. The new governor of Colorado, Jared Polis, has committed to 100% renewables, as have governors-elect Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan and J.B. Pritzker of Illinois.
Because Democrats won control of the House of Representatives, Eddie Bernice Johnson will be the new chair of the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. On her priority list is fighting global warming, which is in line with Nancy Pelosi's intention to create a select panel on climate change if she becomes Speaker.
The effects of climate change are playing out in real time in California as late last week, devastating wildfires exploded from north to south.
As of this report, 25 people perished in separate fires. Hundreds of thousands have been evacuated as dryness made worse by global warming is leading to repeated record-breaking fires.
According to a study from the University of California, there are two distinct fire seasons in the southern part of the state, summer and fall. Summer fires are driven by extreme heat, which will be worsened with global warming.
In the fall, Santa Ana winds blow dry desert air south and west. These low moisture winds dry out vegetation and, as climate change continues, will contain even less humidity and could ignite more wildfires.
Wolves are helping to restore streams. According to a study over 13 years from Oregon State University, the return of the animals in Yellowstone National Park has improved stream structure and function.
In the 1990s, elk were eating the stream bank willows and keeping them short, causing erosion and damaged waterways. The researchers found that after the return of wolves and cougars, the elk did not eat so much of the willows.
In a release from the university, the researchers said that by 2017, there was a significant increase in the willow canopy over streams, which also helped to stabilize banks, resulting in a recovering riparian ecosystem.
The improvements are also leading to the return of beavers in part of the study areas. The critters enhance vegetation by connecting floodplains and streams through their dams.
Speaking of dams, the authors of a new study are warning that many large-scale hydropower projects in Europe and the U.S. have been disastrous for the environment.
Published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the researchers say that dams built since the 1930s have damaged river ecology, displaced millions of people, and have contributed to climate change by releasing greenhouse gases from decomposing lands and forests.
The multidiscipline study addressed plans for hydropower in less developed areas of the world, warning that proponents are being blindsided by the prospect of cheap electricity without considering the full environmental and social costs.
The BBC reports that about 3,700 new dams are in the works for rivers in Africa and Asia.
In the U.S. and Europe, dozens of dams are being removed. Hydropower supplies only about 6% of the electricity in the U.S., where dam building reached a peak in the 1960s.
When one thinks of where drought can occur, the Caribbean may not come to mind, but millions of people in that region are facing increased food insecurity and decreasing fresh water as climate change dries the area.
A Cornell University study published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters shows that since 1950, there's been a drying trend, and some multi-year droughts, such as the severe one from 2013 to 2016.
During that time in Haiti, over half of the crops were lost, which resulted in a million people being food insecure, meaning they lack access to safe and nutritious foods to meet their dietary needs.
Lead author Demetrius Herrera said in the Cornell Chronicle that human-caused warming accounted for an increase in the severity of droughts, and the situation will worsen over time.
Freshwater supplies may also dwindle as rising seas increase saltwater intrusion. The study comes as recent hurricanes devastated Caribbean islands.
And finally, we've heard how important sleep is to well-being. It can help reduce stress and inflammation, improve memory, and maintain a healthy weight. But there's another reason to get more sleep. It could help prevent dehydration.
A new study from Penn State reports that adults who get only 6 hours of sleep per night are more likely to be dehydrated than those who get 8 hours.
The reason has to do with a hormone called vasopressin, which instructs the body to store water during sleep, since people don't drink while getting shut-eye.
According to lead author Asher Rosinger, vasopressin is released later in the sleep cycle. So if you're sleeping less, you're not getting that last dose and waking up dehydrated and feeling not rested.
Luckily, there's an easy fix. Drink plenty of fluids throughout the day and limit caffeine, tea, and alcohol.
That's it for This Week in Water. Sweet dreams, and we'll see you next time.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
Now the calendar of events for the week of 11-12-18. There'll be a Green Business Network Fall Social, November 12th, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Boulevard Brewing Company, 2501 Southwest Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. Register in advance at bridgingthegap.org. Heartland Tree Alliance needs volunteers at Pleasant Valley Park Tree Planting, November 13, 1 to 4 p.m., Pleasant Valley Park, 6401 Pleasant Valley Road, Kansas City, Missouri. And Heartland Tree Alliance needs volunteers for the Red Bridge Neighborhood Street Tree Planting, Saturday, November 17th, 9 a.m. to noon, Red Bridge Neighborhood, 11624 Cherry Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Kansas City Wildlands needs volunteers for Ecological Restoration Workday, Saturday, November 27th, November 17th, 9 a.m. to noon, Og Road Prairie, Shawnee Mission Park, entrance at 7900 Renner Road, Shawnee, Kansas. Another volunteer opportunity is the Brush Creek Watershed Litter Cleanup, Saturday, November 17th, 9:30 a.m., 12 p.m., Brush Creek Watershed, Elmwood, 4600 East 49th Street, Kansas.